The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, and welcome to The Women's Hour. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. Beginning today with the New York Times. The Politics and Power of Pregnancy Images. Prominent women in the MAGA world draw attention to pro-natalist sentiments. By Vanessa Friedman. Last week, in between trips to Europe to negotiate a peace deal with Iran, Vice President J.D. Vance and his very pregnant wife, Usha, posted a Father's Day Instagram reel talking about how much they love reading to their kids and about the imminent arrival of their fourth child. Luckily, there's going to be a new baby for you to read to, the second lady says to her husband. So you're going to have many more years ahead of you. She is wearing a stretchy coral dress that hugs her stomach, making what she is talking about very clear. He grins and says, I was not yet ready to be out of the baby phase, so here we are, about to jump right in. As a promo for the first public pregnancy of a vice presidential family since Eileen Colfax, the wife of Schuyler Colfax, in 1870, it doesn't get any clearer than that. And it follows the equally public pregnancies of the Trump world figures, Caroline Leavitt and Katie Miller. Leavitt, the White House press secretary, gave birth to her second child on May 1st and has just returned from maternity leave. Katie Miller, the wife of Stephen Miller, a White House Deputy Chief of Staff, had their fourth child on June 3rd. That three such prominent women in the MAGA movement were pregnant at about the same time was, indubitably, a coincidence. But for an administration that has such an intuitive and strategic understanding of the power of aesthetics, that an unspoken dress code in which men outfit themselves in the image of the president has developed, it's also a telling one. Together, the women have created a notably consistent and somewhat paradigm-shifting picture of the White House's family and fertility platform. If the bare-chested, muscled mixed martial arts fighters that President Trump hosted on Flag Day were the poster guys for MAGA's image of masculinity, then the pregnant women of Trump world are one half of their feminine counterparts, along with the sheath-clad, lip-filled, pageant-haired Mar-a-Lago set. They offer an image of idealized womanhood that gives literal shape to the pro-natalist movement. It almost feels like a memo went out, said Jill Filipovic, the host of the Week in Women podcast. They have quite intentionally opted to present themselves as, I am really pregnant. And this is what women were chosen to do. And they are happy to say that both with their looks and their mouths. If in doubt, simply consider posts on X and Instagram last month from Miller, who was then some 9 months pregnant. In honor of Mother's Day, she wrote, a reminder that peak feminism is having babies. The most radical thing a woman can do is embrace her biological destiny. Along with her words came a portrait taken from the side in which Miller is shown wearing low-slung, unbuttoned jeans and a black sports bra, her hair cascading in waves down her back. Like the stretchy and black knit Millie dress with a tulip on the front worn by Usha Vance for a military mother's event at the White House, and the form-fitting gowns worn by Leavitt and Miller to the White House Correspondents' Dinner in April. The photograph placed Miller's rounded stomach front and center, enshrining her pregnancy for all to see. It's a notable change from the wardrobe choices of former political spouses like Cherie Blair, who surprised Britain when she became pregnant while her husband, Tony Blair, was prime minister. Their son, Leo, was born in 2000. Her maternity style consisted primarily of tunics and other loose-fitting attire. Ditto Jacqueline Kennedy, who, when she was carrying a child during the 1960 presidential campaign, wore empire waist dresses and trapeze-like shapes that skimmed her pregnant body to leave most of its reality to the imagination. It's also a change, said Helen Lewis, the author of Difficult Women, A History of Feminism in 11 Fights, from the wardrobes of professional women of yore, whose clothes were designed largely to disguise their pregnancies, lest they be regarded as stumbling blocks to work. And while it mirrors much of modern style and speaks to the body positivity movement, the look is also a departure from the tradwife aesthetic that has grown with the MAGA movement and features more smock-like and demure pregnancy clothes on its influencer moms. Indeed, ever since Vance, Leavitt, and Miller revealed their pregnancies, their public appearances have showcased their growing stomachs. There was Vance in April, on a trip with her husband in Hungary, in a body-hugging lilac sweater and a satin skirt, cradling her growing stomach. Here she was later that month, greeting King Charles III in another body-aware dress. There was Leavitt at Christmas in a stretchy knit dress, hand atop her belly. Here was Miller at Trump's New Year's Eve party at Mar-a-Lago in a bias-cut halter gown, arm also cupping her stomach. Forget the maternity moo-moo. Forget body con. This is baby con. In case you missed it, the hand serves to focus the eye. It's really noticeable that the MAGA women are not hiding their pregnancy, Lewis said. There is pride in being pregnant and being fertile. They are modeling the idea, she said, that one of the ways women can hold power is by being mothers and leaning in to the imagery of that. This is particularly striking when it comes to Vance, in part because she is the most reticent Trump world figure and the woman who least fits the obvious mold. Before announcing her pregnancy, she spoke on Meghan McCain's podcast about feeling that three children was enough. According to the Vice President's new book, Communication, it was hearing from Charlie Kirk's widow, Erica, that she regretted not having more children before her husband was killed that helped change Usha's mind. I think I had already started to open my mind to the possibility, Usha told CBS News in an interview. I wouldn't say this was for me in any way the decisive factor, but it came in the middle of a conversation that we were already having. Vance acknowledged that her choice of clothes reflected her change in circumstance. In March, she told NBC News, I have to dress up a lot more. I enjoyed my last pregnancy. There were a lot of sweatpants. I was working from home and sometimes put a blazer on over what was under. As Second Lady, her job is to represent and humanize the Vice President. By spotlighting her pregnancy, she is doing that. I want more babies in the United States of America, her husband said in a 2025 speech. She is showing the world that starts at home. The result, Filipovic said, is that you have some of the most powerful women in the country throwing themselves not just behind these ideas, but creating the aesthetics that propagate these ideas. That, she said, is very influential. Continuing with the New York Times, Sandra Boynton is not silly. Now that her books have crossed generations of child-rearing, they deserve another look. By Brian Getty. Next year marks the 50th anniversary of Sandra Boynton's first book, Hippos Go Berserk. It's a counting book, 1 to 9 and back again. You would think it would go to 10, but after 9 hippos come to work in maitre d' uniforms, all the hippos go berserk at a raucous hippo house party, except for the few who looked concerned or bored. It feels very 1970s, an art house plus kids formula, like early Sesame Street. Now that Boynton's books have crossed generations of child-rearing, they deserve another look. We can start with Hippos Go Berserk, which does not go berserk, if readers are paying attention, and here I mean grown-up readers who are usually present at story time. If bored or preoccupied, they would notice that while the focus soon shifts from the original hippo all alone, who called two hippos on the phone, to the number of additional hippos arriving sequentially at the door in ever larger groups, the number of hippos inside the house, not shown, is growing quadratically. At the point of going berserk, there are 1+2+3+4+5+6+7+8+9=45 hippos in the house. And you can count each one, although doing so takes some focus for a reader of any age, because they're all over the place. Though it didn't win any children's book awards when it was published in 1977, Hippos Go Berserk was inducted into the Mathematical Sciences Research Institute's Mathical Hall of Fame in 2020. The best part about the book is that it doesn't say anything about math, linear or quadratic. It took some years before I realized going berserk was so calculated. I was preoccupied. What can I say? Or, as a buyer of prize-winning and precious books, I was predisposed against the idea that Boynton's work offered anything beyond colors, animal sounds, ABC 123, and moments of zaniness. Having a book that's abundantly math marketable, but not calling attention to that fact, is key to Boynton. Her work is so ubiquitous, it feels like the result of a corporate strategy, but it's not. For a half century, she has only done what she herself has wanted to do. She concludes, the unbelievably fascinating autobiography on her website with these words. I choose the projects I do and products I design somewhat at whim, and only if there's a company that looks interesting to work with. I only license what I can develop and design myself, rather than letting companies adapt my characters according to their own sense and sensibility. I have no agent, no business manager, no contracts attorney. This is a rather haphazard way to do things, but it's more fun than an actual plan. Since I'm not sufficiently committed to optimizing market potential, I seem to be a bewilderment, and, one hopes, a minor annoyance to many. The website itself, a World Wide Web 1.0 collection of static, flat, long-scrolling web pages with minuscule font, is a case in point. And yet, according to Simon and Schuster, her primary publisher, Boynton has sold more than 90 million books. In interviews, she has responded to this number by saying, mostly to friends and family. The summer after her junior year at Yale, because she couldn't face the prospect of waitressing again, Boynton started making hand-painted gift and greeting cards, which she trudged around to various East Coast stores to sell. Since then, she has designed more than 8,000, most notably Hippo Birdie to Use, her best-selling card at 10 million and counting. These are astronomical numbers, but they have yielded only a handful of book awards. Chloe and Maud won the Irma Black Award, given by the Bank Street College of Education in 1986. Barnyard Dance and Your Personal Penguin won National Parenting Publications gold medals in 1994 and 2006, respectively. And the songbook for Blue Moo, 17 jukebox hits from way back never, one of the seven albums she wrote with the musician Michael Ford, won the Book Illustration Award from the National Cartoonist Society in 2008. The same year, the Society honored her with a Lifetime Achievement Award. She seems to be more celebrated in the world of entertainment. Another album, Philadelphia Chickens, not only went platinum, more than a million copies sold, but also was nominated for a Grammy in 2004. Boynton and Ford's albums are house parties in themselves. Each takes up a genre of music and is star-studded with musicians. Yo-Yo Ma, B.B. King, Brian Wilson, and actors Meryl Streep, Samuel L. Jackson, Kate Winslet. Boynton has also won several film festival awards for her music videos. As for the major picture book prizes, it may be that her work is ineligible. Its lighter-than-light simplicity may not meet the read-aloud standards set by the E.B. White Award. Its toothless readers may be too early on the beginning reader scale to be considered for the Theodore Seuss Geisel Award. The Caldecott Committee may not be inclined to give its highest honor to Bath Time, which has had the distinction in our home of being used as a platform boat in the bath toy flotilla. But all this raises questions about what is honored in the world of children's literature and why. Sandra Boynton, the third of four children, was born in 1953 in Orange, New Jersey, and raised in Philadelphia. Her father was an English teacher and administrator at a Quaker high school. Her mother, Boynton drolly states on her website, did everything else, and admirably. Boynton graduated from Yale in 1974, a member of the university's second class to admit women, then enrolled in but left two graduate theater programs, the first at the University of California, Berkeley, and the second at Yale. She married Jamie McEwen, who was, among other things, an Olympic canoeist and later a writer of children's books, and they had four kids. They raised their family in the foothills of the Berkshire Mountains in rural northwestern Connecticut, where she still lives. McEwen died of cancer in 2014. You can see Boynton's theater background in her books, not only in the occasional Dancing Across the Page, the vaudevillian rhinos with hats and canes in Rhinoceros Tap come to mind, but also in the comedy. For example, Blue Hat, Green Hat, A Book of Colors begins with an elephant, a moose, and a bear cub wearing hats and looking at the reader with Boynton's signature wide eyes, while Oops, a turkey is standing in a hat. The gag continues as the turkey puts on a shirt, pants, and shoes, not just incorrectly, but absurdly. In the book's final pages, the turkey is dressed correctly, but then, oops, jumps off the high dive into a swimming pool. Cymbal splash, curtain drop, and the joke is on us. If we had known the turkey was dressing for a swim, our reactions and directions would have been different. The punchline plays on an audience assumption The first one being that the plot of a colors book would be about colors. And by the time our assumptions come clear, it's too late to do anything about the situation but laugh. Now the turkey is never going to want to take our directions. How will any of us learn? In 2001, Boynton gave a talk at Yale called The Curious Misuse of a Yale Education. Prior to the talk, she acknowledged the university's exclusively male tradition. Yale had this commitment to 1,000 male leaders a year, she told the Yale Bulletin and Calendar. When they added women, they kept the 1,000 male leaders a year commitment for a while. We used to joke, and 250 overqualified housewives. When asked about her own experience, however, Boynton said, "Women became, I think quite quickly, pretty much a natural part of the Yale landscape. There wasn't this big issue of males versus females. You were all just Yale students." Gender politics is a curious question in Boynton's work. On the one hand, she's an Ivy League trailblazer, a brazenly independent businesswoman, and an astronomically prolific and successful artist. What's more, her towering presence in the world of kids' books is under-acknowledged because her talents are entirely devoted to brightening the days of the very young, and in turn, the days of those who care for the very young, traditionally and currently, given the preschool scene, as least as I have known it, women. On the other hand, I get the idea that Boynton isn't interested in a feminist argument. There is not a whiff of politics in her humor. That said, not being political is a political choice, and I sometimes wonder if it advocates, even unwittingly, a social conservatism that has overqualified housewives doing everything else and admirably. At the end of the day, at bedtime reading, I mean, politicizing Boynton's board books feels like explaining linear and quadratic math in Hippo's Go Berserk. We could do it, and maybe we should, but we'd miss her point. And what is her point? During the question and answer session, after her 2016 lecture at Harvard's Graduate School of Education, called The Pursuit of Hipponess, Boynton said what she liked about her work was its innocence. Yet it's not inauthentic, and it's not silly. And there can be a tendency to think that things are funny if you trash innocence, and I think it's toxic to trash innocence. Politics, awards, and an optimal marketing plan, all of this trashes innocence. Even silly is questionable in modern parenting parlance, as it is so often a euphemism for misbehaving. We say, "You're being silly," to mean stop being bad. Not inauthentic is a canny double negative. Her work is not authentically childlike or childish. Authentic childishness in an adult, artist or otherwise, is just immature. Boynton's work is mature beyond its appearance. Deceptively simple is how we usually put it, but only in the way that kids might appear deceptively simple-minded. There's nothing simple-minded about kids, and nothing simple-minded about Boynton's books. Kids and Boynton have made this connection right under the nose of the adult reader. As in the case of the inappropriately dressed turkey, the joke is on us. Boynton's books really, truly know children and child care morning, noon, and night. To this I can attest. Our youngest is 9, so we are long past picture book read-alouds. In fact, we are purging our kids' bookshelves. But I will keep all of Boynton's humor and wisdom for someone's future use. Boynton knows, for instance, that it's just now dawn, which means you've been awake for a couple of hours, and your child is finally back asleep for the first unplanned nap of the day. See, snoozers. She knows that when you get them up, you'll make them 3 separate breakfasts, because they have to eat something, or there'll be a tantrum ticking time bomb. See, hey, wake up. She knows that you may be delayed getting out the front door because they're hungry, tired, or having an existential crisis. See, what's wrong, little Pookie? She knows that all you do around the house is clean up messes, especially on holidays. See, birthday monsters. She knows what the approach of evening makes clear, that as your life has been subsumed with the care of another, a day has gone by, and the most you can do is maintain a semblance of self. See, but not the hippopotamus. But this is okay, or even better, it's something to be proud of. See, but not the armadillo. And wow, does she know the 5-act drama of bedtime? She knows, I'm not tired, just before total collapse. See, night, night, little Pookie. She knows the effort to keep the bedtime routine under 2 hours. See, the going-to-bed book. She knows the ordeal of getting kids in the bath, then the ordeal of getting kids out of the bath, then the ordeal of pajamas. See, pajama time. She knows the burst of energy as you try to wind down. See, all of the above. She knows the clean-up, clean-up, everybody, everywhere song, and that, for the most part, everybody, everywhere, is just you. She also knows that the house is picked up enough, and that, for one more day of parenting, you, like your child, have been good enough. See, yay, you! And, woo-hoo, you're doing great. She knows that there is a lowest moment in each day when all has gone wrong with the most basic functions of living. Eating, sleeping, pooping, hopefully not in public, but if so, then hopefully in a sympathetic public. And that the way to endure is to remember that there will be a corresponding moment when your dear little toddler tyrant will evoke in you a love more powerful exponentially powerful than any feelings you ever thought possible. She knows that what takes the greatest virtue is not enduring the lowest moment, but being able, being open, to fully take in the highest. And somehow, I swear, she knows that after bedtime, when you finally get a minute for yourself, what do? You scroll through the pictures of your kids you took that day. Boynton concludes her Harvard lecture with two quotations I wish I had heard earlier in my parenting life. The first is from Tom Stoppard's The Coast of Utopia. A character wisely observes, because children grow up, we think a child's purpose is to grow up, but a child's purpose is to be a child. The second quotation is from Samuel Johnson. Allow children to be happy in their own way, for what better way will they find? Then Boynton plays a video of what she calls one of the best reviews I've ever received for any of my books. A 9-month-old listening to their dad read Blue Hat, Green Hat is laughing uncontrollably, just busting a gut. A minute of perfectly toothless joy. From Cosmopolitan. Being a girl is more fraught than ever, but I love it. Why should Tradwives and Sabrina Carpenter have all the fun? By Sophie Kemp. A loud restaurant, uptown, east side. The waiters are all wearing tuxes. We order a bottle. I'm in a black dress, skin tight, very short, LeMay blazer, a runway piece that I debuted when I was still a child. He's in his suit. He tops off my glass. The walls are all wood, with hanging paintings of Italian farmhouses. We are seated at a square bistro table with bentwood chairs. This happened when I was 28 years old, in the absurdly early stages of a relationship. The women around me all have their skin pulled back. They are fawning over their husbands. They are drinking white wine and crossing their legs. They are reapplying their makeup, checking their appearances in their compact mirrors. Our waiter takes our order. You're in the middle of the action, he says. Best table. This is a moment from the recent past where I have felt the most like a girl, a girlfriend, a girl in a sea of girls. It was never obvious to me how one is supposed to be a girl in the classic sense. As a child, I think I was 4 years old. I would sit on the sink of my grandmother's bathroom. You apply the foundation first, she'd say, and after that comes the blush. She did it on herself, showing me how she blended it. Then she'd do it on me. Beautiful, she'd say. So beautiful. My grandmother was a woman who, in the mid-century, did all of her shopping in a Celine suit. My grandmother was someone who once drove her cherry red Triumph at a speed that led to its inevitable destruction. It quite literally burst into flames. As a child, I thought being a girl was being just like her. A little blush, a little foundation. You do the shopping in your sports car and your suit. You wait for your husband at home. I tried to shape myself in her image. I wore calico sundresses and patent leather Mary Jane shoes. My hair was cut into a bob by a woman who did it in her garage to the tune of pop music. She held up photos of Katie Holmes printed in tabloid magazines and said to me, "This is who you look like, girl." I told the ladies at school my dream was to be a professional rock climber, a summer camp counselor, or a novelist in order of preference. I thought about being a girl in black and white terms, as I suppose many young girls do. There was a set of rules, girl dogma, that made it simpler for me. A girl wears a dress. She coats her lips in something sweet. She crosses her legs. Her bicycle is pink, and it has blue and purple tassels at the end. She picks a boy, and that boy is her main priority. In the years after my childhood, I dabbled in all of the usual rebellions. I shaved different parts of my head. I bleached my hair blonde and dyed my bangs pink. I threw my body into amplifiers at punk shows. I got so stoned, I passed out in a supermarket on the outskirts of the idyllic small town where I attended college. I got kicked out of at least three different bars in Paris, France. This was an era when I thought I was living my life in such a pure and different way, that I had distanced myself from the rigidity of being a girl by living such an interesting and messed up life. But then something changed. Culturally, we are living in a girl moment. And now that I'm an adult, there's something especially seductive about the rigidity of being a girl. It feels very scientific again. It feels good to lean into the artificiality of it all, to be a little bit plastic. Right now, it doesn't seem so bad to be like Addison Rae, singing about boys and money and clothes, or Sabrina Carpenter, who is getting her hair pulled by a man in a suit on the cover of her new album. It doesn't seem so bad to be so sweet, to opt for an extremist, hetero-optimism instead of its inverse. And I don't think it sets women back to play the role of the blonde in the headlights, the perfect girlfriend. In fact, I'm frustrated by the idea that it even has to be subversive. I'll grant that it's a little controversial in a moment where it is so particularly fraught to be assigned female at birth. Why does it have to be? The key, I think, is self-awareness, to feel like you have autonomy over what you're doing, that there is something fun about being a little bit retrograde. It makes me feel like I'm in a video game, to play the role of girl, girlfriend, whatever. It can be like this. Girl gets all prim and proper. Girl removes the necessary body hair. Girl puts on the necessary frock. Girl intuits what her man wants. Girl is what her man wants. What I'm trying to say is, you have to know what you're doing and why you're doing it. What I'm trying to say is that women sometimes want this in a way that isn't pathological. At least for me, exploring the aesthetics of rigid femininity came in a period when I started to become more confident. Being a girl feels less threatening to me. It started to feel fun. It became my favorite game. It didn't feel like something I needed to rebel against, at least not actively. I was entering an intense creative period. I was starting to become successful for making art. I wrote a novel about a girl who is so good at playing the part of girlfriend that she straight up gets dumped. I no longer had the impulse to shave different parts of my head. I became interested in the idea of dressing in a way that was appealing to men. I became interested in being in romantic relationships that weren't mutually destructive, relationships that were happy. But while being a self-aware girl can be fun, you can still really get hurt. It can still be scary, scary, scary. And that's the risk you're going to run. I'm saying this because I've gotten really hurt, and I knew exactly what I was doing when I got hurt. People and girls with agency still get hurt. There was something that happened to me recently. It happened with the man from the restaurant with the Brentwood chairs. In our relationship, I played the part of girl, and I think it might have been the best performance of my career yet. And by this I mean I watched myself being a girlfriend, like I was watching myself on a stage in a black box of a theater. I was kind and pretty and sweet. I was almost never myself, and I knew exactly what I was doing. I let myself become diminutive. I let my thoughts slow down, and I let myself become more soft-spoken. I consented to all of it, and I had agency in everything. I was a perfect little hologram. I don't regret anything, because that's my favorite thing about playing girl. Allowing yourself to love and be loved by men and seeing what happens. Letting yourself roll the dice. To be like Helen and wail at the walls of Troy. That is what it means to play girl. That is the trickiest part of the whole charade. Allowing someone else into that fantasy, knowing that you might get really, really hurt, and then knowing that afterward, you're going to be okay, because you will be, because you already are. From the Boston Globe. Hegseth cuts leave female Navy officers dispirited. By Constantine Turopin. Washington. After Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth cut 9 Navy officers, including all the women, from a promotion list, several female officers say they see the unusual intervention as a sign that their careers now have a ceiling and worry for the future generation of female military leaders. The Navy had selected 31 sailors to promote from the rank of captain to one-star admiral. But Hegseth recently intervened to strike 9 people from the list, including 3 women and 2 black men, according to a defense official who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss information not permitted to be released publicly. As a result, the Navy is not promoting a single woman to the one-star admiral rank this year, even though women make up about 1/4 of all Navy officers and nearly 1/3 of the sea service's mid-grade ranks, according to data from 2024. The Associated Press spoke with 8 female Navy officers of varying ranks and time in service after Hegseth cuts, which were reported earlier by the New York Times, became public. They spoke on condition of anonymity. The more junior officers said they saw the development as a sign that their careers would become politicized if they rose too far in the ranks, and some said they felt they now had a limit on how far they could be promoted. Some said it made them feel less valued within the military and wondered whether that wasn't part of the intent. The Pentagon has not offered any rationale on why the women or any of the others were removed from the promotions list. The Navy's process for choosing which officers to promote to the one-star rank has been relatively constant over the years. The service convenes a group of officers that examines the records of eligible officers and chooses the most qualified. The board that selected the initial slate of 31 officers for promotion was directed by Navy Secretary John Phelan, an appointee of President Trump, who later departed his post in April, to recommend for promotion the best qualified officers within their respective competitive category. Hegseth has long argued, without offering evidence, that women in the military benefit from preferential treatment and are not suited for combat roles. For too long, we've promoted too many uniformed leaders for the wrong reasons, based on their race, based on gender quotas, based on historic so-called firsts, Hegseth told hundreds of military leaders in September. The approach, he asserted, made the Pentagon less capable and less lethal. The full list of 31 people to be promoted was approved by Phelan, other Navy leaders, and the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, before it reached Hegseth. From Nature's Market Basket, Managing Stress, Strategies to Help You Calm Down, by Nan Fornall. You're stressed, running late, and stuck in a traffic jam. There's not much you can do about acute stress besides taking deep, calming breaths. But acute stress is only one of 3 types. The other 2 are acute episodic, such as with recurring work deadlines, and chronic, which may have many causes. These 2 beat you down from day to day as the fight or flight response takes over. Before you're caught in a loop that can cause health problems, consider these tips. Follow a healthy diet. There's clear medical evidence that nutrition affects our emotional well-being and can reduce the risk of anxiety. Boost nutrient intake. Anxiety-relieving foods may contain high-quality protein, fiber, probiotics, omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin B12, and magnesium. This group includes salmon, avocado, beef in moderation, chicken, eggs, plain yogurt, and vegetables. Avoid low-nutrition foods and beverages. Heavily processed foods, especially those containing sugar, trans fats, or artificial sweeteners, are full of empty calories instead of packed with nutrients. Beverages containing alcohol or caffeine also don't help. Practice mindful eating. Stress eating may involve shoving food down without even thinking about what it is and what it does for or to the body. As anyone who's ever eaten half a bag of candy knows, after you've chosen a quality meal, focus on the food and chew it slowly. Exercise. You can lower both blood pressure and levels of stress hormones with aerobic exercise. Relax and breathe. Whether or not you meditate or do Tai Chi or yoga, your body will respond to the tension-lowering effects of deep breathing. Ensure good sleep. Aim for 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night and prepare for it by slowing down in the evening. Turn off the TV, put down your electronic devices, and relax with a bath or a book. And that brings us to the end of the program. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. And please join me again for the Women's Hour.
This is Bird Note. When taking public transportation, you might read a book or listen to a podcast. But what if you used your commute to do a little birding? On the way to the bus or train stop, you might see a common grackle hopping along the curb. Or hear a house finch belting it out from a street tree. If the light rail goes over a river or passes by the shore, keep an eye out for gulls, herons, and birds that go diving for fish. And on the ride, you can also take comfort in knowing that you're helping birds by using public transportation and avoiding a potential car trip. By carrying more people in a single vehicle, mass transit can use less energy than cars. Taking steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions can help the hundreds of bird species put at risk by climate change. Not to mention, while driving a car, you can't just relax and tune in to the birds all around you. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Remmel. This episode is dedicated to Kit Ellis of Gig Harbor, Washington, with thanks for her generous support of Bird Note.